Dicemo apura kanu apura kaitnut neye ojira da medinde ojira po kwesi ra nehem pata akan akwamu mai na maruka etipi mu ojira po. That means greetings to all apura kani apura kaitni people, meaning Africans, black people. Today is ojira da ojira de. My name is ojira po kwesi ra nehem pata akan ojira po of the akwamu nation in North America. Yirase for tuning in. Today we're going to have good discussion. We're opening up the chat room right now. And we're also, the phone lines are open for those individuals who would like to comment or have a question in the chat room. Of course, you must log in and get a username. If you don't have a username, create a username and log in order to comment or pose a question. On the phone line, just hit the number 1 to raise your hand so we can call on you. And what we're going to do right now is I'm going to put a couple of links in the chat room on a couple of the documents that we are going to touching on. So the first link we put, and for those on the phone, on our website, Kamur, Kamet Ori, Asar, Offset and the enslavement and restoration of the Afurakani, Afuraikaitni, the African individual in Amenti in the West. We're going to touch on that. And, of course, we had the link as well to the, when we sent the notification out, we had the link to the webcast, who is Afurakanu, Afuraikaitni, and who is not. So, of course, we're going to touch on that information as well. If anybody has any questions about any of that information, of course, you can post them at any time in the chat room. We're also posting a link to a transliteration of the great hymn, quote-unquote, to the Aten by Akhenaten. We're going to talk about that. That's going to be included in this discussion. And one more link that we should post, and that was posted in the notification as well, is the emergence of Sekhmet Hetheru Ari Ra, the emergence of Sekhmet. And we're going to get into that as well. And I'm going to post that real quick before we get started. And that particular link, the emergence of Sekhmet, is a portion of the text typically called the Book of the Cow of Heaven, or sometimes called the Destruction of Mankind. That particular text dealing with the destruction of mankind, the certain group of men and women who are engaging in disordered activity. Ra directs Sechima Sekhmet to attack and destroy these individuals and kill these individuals. So included in that is the emergence of Sechima or Sekhmet at Heru Ari Ra. And that's very important for the discussion we're going to have tonight. So those three, and some people who just joined in, that is our document on the website, odirafo.com, O-D-W-I-R-A, F as in free, O.com. You can go there and just scroll through the introduction. You'll see various documents, Kamur, Kamet, Ori, Asar, Offset, and the Enslavement and Restoration of the Afurakani, Afuraikaitni, or African in Amenti, the West, that particular one. Then also you can download the emergence of Sechima, or the emergence of Sekhmet Hetheru Ari Ra. Download that one as well. We're going to get into that. And then we also linked to one of the transliterations of the great hymn to the Aten by Akhenaten, and we're going to deal with that as well. And we're going to touch on some other documents that also we just wanted to post those for specific information that we're going to touch on. All right, I'm just checking a couple of messages right quick. I want to make sure we didn't miss anyone. All right. Okay. Michiawo. All right. And actually, one more link. and this is a link. It's in Google Books. It's just a section from the story of Anaset, retold by Plutarch, Osiris, and Isis. And there's a specific section in there that we're going to look at. So we're going to paste that, and we'll read it on during the course of the discussion. But we just want to paste that for people who are looking online. Post it up, paste it in the chat room. We'll get to that. So when we're talking about this particular webcast, you know, Ojida, and of course Ojida, as we say, Ojida in the Akan language means purification. Jida, the verb, means to purify. Ojida means purification. It also means a celebration of purification. So many Akan people call the New Year celebration that we hold around on the continent around August, September, or October in Akwamu Mine, Amadukai Tipimu, in the Akwamu Nation in North America. Our seven-day New Year celebration is always in September. It's a seven-day observance, and we talked about in the previous webcast in details about our Ojida celebration or Obrajida celebration, which is actually coming up in a couple of weeks. It's between September 16th and September 22nd or September 17th through September 23rd, depending on the first day of the Atemet or autumn equinox. That's our first day of our new year, and then 7 days prior to that, beginning either on September 16th or September 17th, is the first day of the celebration, and the last day of the celebration, the seventh day, is the first day of the autumn equinox, and that's our New Year's Day. And that will be coming up in September in a few weeks, and that will be the beginning of the year 13,015. We're at 13,014 right now. We'll be in 13,015 on September 22nd. And, of course, we don't calculate our time based on a fictional cartoon character, Jesus, who never existed. So, of course, we don't calculate from 2,000 years ago or 2,014 years ago because nothing happened 2,014 years ago to calculate from. We are in the midst of the Afe Kessie, or the great Afe, the great year, which Europeans sometimes call the Platonic year or the great year. That is a 26,000-year cycle on average, where the equinoctial point of the Orea, the sun, moves through the various constellations that cross the ecliptic, and that takes 26,000 years. We are in the midst of that cycle. This is why we use the year 13,015 as an astronomical cycle, and it's directly connected to the Arbosome that govern these different great constellations and so forth. And in upcoming broadcasts, we're going to deal with the so-called zodiac, where the White Sun offspring lifted that from our people, how it's been corrupted. Of course, the dates that you see in the newspapers, for example, the tropical zodiac, where they have the dates between, you know, April 21st or March 21st and April 21st and April 21st to May and so forth, those dates are not accurate, even with the sidereal charts that many individuals use, and they consider the sidereal charts more accurate. They're not much more accurate either. If you look at an astronomical zodiac to see exactly where the Orea, where the sun is, and what constellations are actually crossing the ecliptic, there are not 12 constellations that cross the ecliptic. There are actually 13. A couple of thousand years ago, because of the precession of the equinoxes and the position of the Earth with regard to constellations, there were only 12 constellations crossing the ecliptic. So those 12 constellations, of course, are governed by different arbosome, and we know who those are. Because of the shift in position, there are now 13 constellations that cross the ecliptic. So that's one difference between the tropical zodiac and the sidereal zodiac, of course, which are inaccurate. And then the other difference is they're not all 30 days. So the sun rising, quote-unquote, and the constellations manifesting across the ecliptic for not 30 days each or 12 months of 30 days or 31 days, they vary. One section is 1 month, quote-unquote, is 7 days. One is 45 days. One is 32 days. It varies. And those different constellations are governed by actual divinities, and they're different from what very often what the whites and their offspring say. For example, when they say the twins or Gemini, Castor and Pollux, the two male twins, that's a corruption. In ancient Kemet, we were talking about Shu and Tufnut, which is a male and female, the male and female twins, children of Atem and Asaset Nebetetepet, male and female divinities, of course, in Akan culture, that's Odomankuma and Asaseafua. And we went into some detail about Atem and Asaset Nebetetepet, because the whites and their offspring, of course, try to say that Atem engaged in self-stimulation, masturbation to create Shu and Tefnut, which is inaccurate. And, of course, the texts bear that out, showing that his wife, Asaset Nebetetepet, also called the hand of the god, she's the great mother, he's the great father, with respect to their birthing, Shu and Tefnut, those two twins. So we go into detail about that. We have a broadcast about that we did a couple of weeks ago. Of course, they're all archived, but so, for example, the twins, Shu and Tefnut, the male and female expansive and contractive force, that's different than two males named Castor and Pollux, which have nothing to do with anything. And if you look at the various different zoology and zoo types that they associate with the zodiac, what you'll find is they are either corruptions or they're totally inaccurate. You have Cancer, we're talking about Kephra, actually the beetle. We're talking about Libra, we're talking about Ma'at and the scales of Ma'at. Virgo is talking about Offset. So there are different divinities, and that's a totally different thing. And it's based on an actual culture and not some manufactured nonsense where people are just giving out little characteristics and that actually match every single person, and anything you read actually applies to you, and it's really not accurate. And it's very hit or miss. If you compare astronomical zodiac and the dates where the sun or Rhea actually is in reference to the constellations that actually appear, there are about 89% of the dates you find in the tropical zodiac that you see in the newspapers are inaccurate. So most people who think that they are Cancer or think that they are Sagittarius or think that they are this or that, actually, all along, you've been none of those things. The dates have been off. So all this time when you've been associating yourself with Capricorn and everything else, 89% of those dates are inaccurate. So if you want to research that, you can look at astronomical zodiac in comparison to tropical zodiac. So that's just a piece. But when we're talking about our 13,015, we're in the midst of that actual astronomical cycle where you can actually track where the actual constellations are, how they affect the Earth, where the Orea is in that place. And just so people know, when they talk about Aquarius, the water bearer who holds the two vials and is pouring libation, that's actually a corruption of Hapi, the Hapi divinity, Hap or Hapi, and we talked about Hapmet or Muhapmet, the waters Mu of Hapmet, the Northern Nile, that's the Northern Nile deity, Muhapmet, and then Muhapreset are the waters Mu of Hap, Nile divinity, Reset of the south. So Muhat Reset are the waters of the northern Nile, that divinity. Then Muhat Met is the divinity operating through the waters of the northern Nile. Of course, Muhat Met is corrupted into Muhammad, fictional character. There was no Muhammad. There was no black Muhammad. There was no white Muhammad. There was no Bilal ever. So we went into that a couple of broadcasts back as well. You can get into that. Hapi, pouring the libation of water into the river to cause the flood, this is where they get Aquarius from. We are not in the age of Hapi or the age of Aquarius. That's about over 600 years into the future. So we're not even close. So when you have people talking about we've entered into the age of Aquarius and it's an information age and start talking about all these characteristics, you know these individuals have no idea what they're talking about. Of course, the whites and their offspring misinform, but you have black people who follow the whites and their offspring, incorporate that nonsense into what appears to be traditional culture, the culture of ancient Kemet and things like that, and they're just repeating the nonsense of the whites and their offspring and try to retroactively date it and make it real, and it's not. All right, so that's the basis of our year. So Ojida, purification, is also the celebration of purification. That's in Akan culture. Of course, as we talked about last night in our new show, our new weekly show, Akan Po Nanasom, Ancient Authentic Akan Ancestral Religion, which is every Joada, every Monday at 9 p.m. on this Blog Talk channel. We started last night. We will continue. So now we have three weekly shows. We have Akan Po Nanasom, Ancient Authentic Akan Ancestral Religion, on Joada, Monday nights at 9 p.m. We have Ojida, which is tonight. Of course, Ben Ada, Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. And then we have Egua, which is Marketplace, where we showcase Afuraikani, Afuraikani businesses, products and services from different individuals, and we interview them, and they share their products and services and also share our ancestral values. That's on Awukuta, Akuata, Wednesdays at 9 p.m. So, but getting back to Ojida being purification, and as we mentioned last night, that in the Akan language being purification, but of course the Akan people migrated. We migrated from ancient Kanat, ancient Kanit land, ancient Nubia. And some of us migrated up into ancient Kemet, and some of us remained in Kanat or Nubia, same language, the same culture. So this is why Jida also means purification in the ancient language, which we show the Medutu or hieroglyphics of ancient Kemet in the language. It means Jida as well, just as it does in the Akan language, of course. And it also means a celebration of purification. So if Jida means purification in ancient Kemet, it also means a celebration of purification in ancient Kemet and Kanat. Jida means, or Ojida means purification in Akan today, and it also means a celebration of purification, which is actually our new year, the time for purification. So it's the same name, the same meaning, same concept. Purification, as we always say, operationalizes Nanasom. Nanasom is Afuraikani, Afuraikaiti, or African ancestral religion, no matter what form it takes, whether it's the expression of Yoruba, Akan, Ebe, Igbo, Maasai, Fula, Ibibio, Ijaw, Malosi, no matter what form it takes, Hoodoo in North America, Juju in North America, Gullah Geechee culture in North America, Voodoo in North America, Obeya in Jamaica, Candomblé, authentic Candomblé in South America, Winti, the Akan tradition in South America and Suriname. No matter what form it takes, Afuraikani, Afuraikai, the ancestral religion, in essence, is the ritual incorporation of divine law and the ritual restoration of divine balance. Through ritual, we incorporate those things, objects, deeds, and entities we need in order to harmonize our thoughts, intentions, and actions with divine order. And through ritual, we restore balance. We reject, destroy disorder and its purveyors, and restore balance to ourselves and our thoughts and our intentions and actions when imbalance has occurred. So we incorporate law and restore balance through ritual, and that's the essence of Afuraikani, Afuraikaiti, ancestral religion. We want to return to divine order, our thoughts, intentions, and actions to divine order. So through ritual, we incorporate law, and through ritual, we restore balance. In order to engage ritual to incorporate on the expansive side to incorporate law and on the contractive side to restore balance, we must engage the process of Jida, purification. And when we purify our thoughts, intentions, and actions, and then we engage in ritual, or Jida, or purification, operationalizes Nanasom. If you're impure in thought and intention, and of course your actions are going to be impure, it doesn't mean that you have to be perfect. That's not what we're talking about. If you recognize that you have specific problems, issues, or whatever, and you have a pure intent because you want to purify yourself, the intent alone, the thoughts and intentions alone are pure because you're seeking to harmonize your thoughts, intentions, and actions with divine order. Now you're moving forward with a pure intent, and then you can purify your behavior as well. You can engage in ritual to assist in that process. So that's why we say, of course, Ojida purifies it, purification. Ojida operationalizes Nanasom. When you have that pure intent, then you can engage ritual practices that will align you and realign you with divine order. So tonight in this particular broadcast, we're dealing with race and identity in Apurakani Apurakaitni cosmology. The whites and their offspring, the Achiwadiefo, as we call them in our formal mind, in the Akan language, Achiwadie. Adie means thing, object, deed, or entity. Chi means to hate. So Achide or Achiwadie means those things, objects, deeds, or entities, Adie, that are hated, divinely hated by the Abosom, the divine forces of nature by the Nananum and Samapo, the spiritually cultivated ancestresses and ancestors, and by Nyamewa and Nyame, the great mother and the great father. Nyamewa is called Amenet in ancient Kemet. Nyame, the great father, is called Ame in ancient Kemet. So that's divine hate. Echiwadie are things that are divinely prohibited, divinely prescribed, divinely rejected, divinely hated. Chi means to hate. Echiwadie means things that are divinely hated. So, of course, we have our book, Modern and Chi, Divine Law, Love, and Divine Hate, the two poles of divine order. You do not understand divine order or a specific arrangement, things that are acceptable, things that are not acceptable, things that are in harmony with order, things that are not. Divine law, which is the same as love in a traditional culture, is the expansive pole of order. Divine hate is the contractive pole of divine order. And we go into detail about that in the book. All right, so the whites and their offspring, of course, the Achiwadiefo, because we call them Achiwadiefo, they are divinely hated, divinely rejected. They are spirits of disorder, and they incarnate as spirits of disorder. White Europeans, white Americans, white Hindus, white Arabs, white pseudo-Native Americans, white Latinos, white Hispanics, and so forth. All non-black people, they incarnate as Achiwadiefo, spirits of disorder, divinely hated, divinely rejected. Just like cancerous cells in your body are rejected by the immune system. They're not embraced. They're isolated, destroyed, and rejected to maintain the integrity of the whole. The whites and their offspring are the cancerous cells in the body of black humanity. They are divinely hated. This is why we refer to them properly as Achiwadiefo, spirits of disorder, divinely hated. The Achiwadiefo, or the whites and their offspring, they teach misinformation about race. First, they began to attempt to teach that white is superior. Of course, they knew that white is inferior. When they invaded ancient Apuraka, Apuraikai, ancient southern Europe, of course, our people were originate in Apuraka, Apuraikai, in Africa. We migrated around the world, starting from the mother continent, migrating up into southern Europe, migrating into what is now the Levant, the so-called Middle East, migrating into in southern India and so-called southern China and Australia and eventually north, central, South America, the Caribbean. We made those migrations tens of thousands of years before any other group of individuals existed. Eventually, when the whites and their offspring came into being in northern Eurasia, thousands of years later, migrating and invading southern Europe and into North Africa, Afrikaid, and so forth, they came in contact with us. Of course, we're civilized. We have a civilized society. We have civilization, a social order rooted in the divine order of creation. They tried to wage war against us. Typically, they were unsuccessful. Our armies were too powerful, whether it was in the Levant or in ancient Kemet. And even when they crushed certain armies, in the Levant for a period, then the armies of ancient Kemet went up into the Levant and crushed the Europeans. And the empire of ancient Kemet was not only ruling Kemet, or so-called Egypt, but they were also ruling areas in the Levant through ancient Kanana, which they call Canaan, which is Palestine and Israel now, all the way up through Syria. So the empire of ancient Kemet governed all those areas. And, of course, we brought our ancestral religious practices with us. So, of course, this is why you see the religion of ancient Kemet, of ancient Apuraka, Apuraikai, all over the Levant. And even prior to that empire stage, when we first just migrated there before the whites and our offspring showed up, of course, we carried our religious practices with us quite naturally. Just like a giraffe is going to carry their giraffe culture wherever they go, of course, wherever we go, we're going to carry our capacity to live in harmony with divine order. So, so the whites in Arab Spring, you know, began invading. After thousands of years of invading and losing, typically, they recognized that the only way that they may be able to gain control of our societies was if they were to corrupt the religion. And they began to try to corrupt the religion, corrupt ideas of the religion, and so forth. That didn't work out too well for them initially. So they had to begin to wait to see who was disgruntled in society, who was against the leadership in society, who was against the king. If there was a succession dispute and there was a new king in place, who was against that? Where were the criminals in society, or where were the disgruntled people in society who were looking to overthrow the leadership and take over in a coup? They began to ally with those kinds of individuals. When they began to ally with those kinds of individuals, there was already a fracturing in the society. When you study ancient Kemet and you study the Trusri, for example, you'll find that there are hundreds of years or a thousand years of stability, and then they talk about an intermediate period, the first intermediate period or the second intermediate period or the third intermediate period, where you have a period where there was chaos, where there was political instability, where there were invasions, where there was a fracturing in society, very often because of succession disputes in certain areas, who was going to be the next king, who's going to be in rulership, and families being split, and that even happens today on the continent, even amongst the Akan. In our recent past, succession disputes often lead to civil conflict and sometimes even civil war. Within the Asante Nation, for example, what we talked about last night, the reason the whites and their offspring were able to take over control and take over rulership of the Asante Nation and annex them in 1901, 12,901, which in the white calendar is 1901, is not because the British were superior. The British had allied with other groups, for example, the Fanti and some other groups, and in an allied coalition, they waged war against the Asante Empire, and they lost. And then they licked their wounds, they reconstituted themselves, and the British, and they talk about the, you know, British Asante Wars or the Anglo-Asante Wars, the British came back with their coalitions and waged war against the Asante Empire again. And this time, they lost again. And then they waged war against the Asante Empire again, and they lost again. The last time they waged war and actually were able to be successful, it wasn't because the British all of a sudden became intelligent and superior. It was because Asante had fallen into a civil war. There was a succession dispute. One Ohene had transitioned to the ancestral realm. There was a dispute between who was going to be the next Ohene, who was going to be the next Asante Ohene, who was going to be the next Asante king, sovereign. One camp wanted one individual, one camp wanted another individual. They fell into civil war, and now they're killing each other. And while they're killing each other, then the British and their coalition attacked from the outside while they were already attacking each other from the inside. And the people who started losing on one side began to defect to the British cause, coalition, and there was a fracturing there, and then the British were able to eventually annex the Asante Empire in 1901. The whites and their offspring have been in the region where the Akan were since 12,472, meaning 1472. They didn't take over and annex the Asante until 1901, and they had the Fanti, for example, in a protectorate in the late 1880, from 12,800. So they were there from the quote-unquote 1400s, late 1400s, through the late 1800s into the 1880s before they took control of anything. So before enslavement began in the Western Hemisphere in the 1400s, through the entire period of enslavement until after 1865 into the 1880s, that nation was not controlled by the whites and their offspring. So when fools try to say the white man has been ruling us for 500 years, they weren't ruling any of those nations in the western part of the continent from before the enslavement process all the way through until after the enslavement process, and most of those West Afurakani, Afurakaitni nations and Central didn't fall under the influence of the Europeans until the 1880s and afterwards, after enslavement was already abolished. So they were not in control. So that's very important. But we were talking about that true story to show that just like there were succession disputes and it caused the fracturing of the Asante Nation, and that allowed the weak, inferior whites and their coalition to be able to finally attack the powerful black nation and defeat them because they were already infighting. The same thing that we have, you know, current true story, recent true story that deals with that, and we can see that the exact same thing happened in ancient Kemet. So it was only when we began to infight and they were, you know, fracturing internally that the whites on the outside, the inferior whites on the outside, could get together in a coalition with some disgruntled Afurakanu Afurai Taitu and wage war against the leadership and cause a fracturing. So when you see the first intermediate period, you see a political period of instability, and then the Middle Kingdom, so-called Middle Kingdom, comes in, and that political instability is removed, and they reestablish society, reestablish their institutions. Of course, the army is strong, and the whites now spring can't deal with them anymore. Then there's another intermediate period where there's a period of instability after, you know, like hundreds and hundreds of years, a small intermediate period where there's chaos, but then they reemerge again. So the whites and offspring weren't militarily powerful enough, for example, to dominate ancient Kemet. It took them thousands of years of invading, and eventually trying to corrupt the religion, they weren't successful at that, and later waiting for a fracturing within the society to cause a disintegration of the society. And once some of our people started migrating away and the society begins to become weaker, then the whites and their offspring begin to take control, and there's just a fracture. Of course, our people migrated west, central, south, reestablished civilization. We talked about that last night, talking about the Akan people, for example, reestablishing Akan civilization in the western part of the continent, the ancient empire of Akanna, later called Ghana, and also the Akan civilization further south in the Savannah and Forest Belt region. So this is how the whites and Arab Spring eventually took control. It took them thousands of years. And then finally, Assyrians, and then the Persians, Greeks, Romans, and later Arabs in successive waves began to dominate in the northern part of the continent. So that's how they got in. Once they got in, of course, allying with those who were disgruntled, of course, some disgruntled, some just sellouts, allying with them, then they began to corrupt the religious practices. It's incremental. It wasn't overnight. So first, start changing the images of the deity. You have Osar and Osset, now they're putting white images of Osar and Osset and calling them Osiris and Isis and many other divinities. This is going on with the Greeks. When Greeks get pushed out by the Romans do the same thing. Eventually the Romans get pushed out by the Arabs, and of course they usher in the other nonsense of Islam. But it's taking hundreds of years, and of course people know about the ecumenical councils, Council of Nicaea and Ephesus and these various, and Chalcedon, and these various councils that last for hundreds of years, over the span of hundreds of years, trying to corrupt the religion inside out, point by point. They reject 99% of the texts of the religion and the culture of the religion. The less than 1% they held on to, they corrupted that, and then they began to promote this notion of black inferiority. It took them a couple of thousand years for even that to begin to stick with our people. They start pushing it amongst, in a major way, with the Romans. The Greeks, at the end of their time, and then the Romans, they start trying to promote the idea that first they were honoring in faith, pretending like they were honoring the ancient, quote-unquote, Egyptian deities, but then they started trying to ridicule them in their documents. Then they started trying to say that black people were inferior, and they started moving in that direction, and it took them hundreds of years. So they began to push this notion that black is inferior. Of course, labeling our people Moors, meaning black, but it's also pejorative, meaning slave, wretched, afflicted, dead. And of course, we have the book, our publication, Moor Means Dead, where we lay that out. They knew we used the term mer in ancient Kemet, meaning slave, servant, vassal, wretched, and so forth, for a living person, meaning the socially dead, living dead, quote-unquote, and then myrrh also used for people who are actually dead, but specifically the damned, those discordant spirits who are out of harmony with order, anxious, discordant, the quote-unquote damned or the dead that are out of harmony with order, those disarrayed, discordant spirits that are dead. So those are called Meru, the dead as well. So they use that term Mer or more to designate as a term for all black people, calling all black people dead. That's a pejorative. Just like you call a crackhead the walking dead. That's a pejorative title, you know, describing the way they operate, the way they think of their being mentally dead. Using the term Mer to apply it to all black people as a designation for black, that, you know, that was a reference, a pejorative reference. Some of our people began to accept these titles because they began to accept the perversion of our ancestral religion, eventually manifesting as the false religion of Christianity, the false religion of Judaism, the false religion of Hinduism and Islam and, of course, Buddhism and so forth. And you'll find in all these white corruptions when the whites and offspring began to manufacture these traditions. And they're all the same tradition. In the West is Christianity, Islam, Judaism, pseudo-esotericism like Kabbalism and Gnosticism and Sufism and so forth. In the East, it's the exact same tradition with the same false divinities. They call it Hinduism or Jainism or Buddhism variations, but you will find the same characters in the West as you find in the East. You look in Hinduism, you'll find the same characters you find with slightly different epithets and sometimes the same epithets that you find in the Bible and the Quran and so forth. So it's the same nonsense, it's the same foolishness that the whites and their offspring produced by corrupting our text and manufacturing fake religions and putting their images as superior and beginning to force, you know, images of our people to be, and black being inferior. They began that process. Just like they use the term black or voodoo. Voodoo actually means deity, divine spirit force in creation. The whites in their brain have black people thinking that voodoo means evil, voodoo means devil, voodoo means criminal, voodoo means all these negative things, and it actually means divinity, literally. Deity, God, goddess, that's what it actually means. The term black has been used as a pejorative. Just to hear the term black, the way the whites and offspring utilize it, if they, some black person calls somebody else black or blackie, then it's fighting words to some black people because they think black in and of itself is inferior, even though it really is not. The whites and offspring began that process. So they began to talk about their inferiority as being white because white is inferior. But they wanted to promote the idea that white is superior because they hate the fact that they are inferior to us. So they want to promote and flip it around and say, well, no, well, we're going to say that white is superior. And they've been promoting that for over a couple of thousand years. For recently, when black people began to look at our truestory and look, actually, okay, well, you say that white skin is superior to black skin. Well, let's start looking at the skin. And what's the difference between white skin and black skin? You have black people making those inquiries from even in America hundreds of years ago with Martin Delaney and the Origin of Races and Colors in the 12,800s, the so-called 1800s. He's already writing about that, a black nationalist, looking into, making inquiries into, okay, where does the skin color come from? Then people starting to look at melanin. You have a number of people writing about melanin. And when we start actually examining, instead of just listening to white people say white skin is superior, we say, okay, well, what is skin color? What makes skin color? What is it all about? And when we start looking at melanin, which we call apatum and tree, we realize and are able to confirm what we've known internally and spiritually all along, that black skin, melanin-dominant skin, is superior to white skin. We've known that internally and spiritually, but now biologically, since we began to examine it, we've recognized that and confirmed that. The whites and their offspring, their skin color is that way because of defection. It's a birth defect that's been passed on generation after generation. Albinism, for example, that depigmentation, that's a mutation. That's not normal, that's a mutation. So when you go out in the sun and you're an albino, you suffer. You develop skin melanomas or skin cancers at the same rate as the average white person would if they spend a lot of time in the sun, because it's not natural. Being depigmented is not natural. Losing the pigment in the skin, the hair, eyes, and so forth is a defect. It's a mutation. It's not natural. Vitiligo is not natural. When people become depigmented, they have a white spot on their body and it begins to spread, and a dark brown person all of a sudden becomes, the entire body becomes white. That's an autoimmune deficiency, a disease. It's not natural, it's disease. So when you see white-skinned individuals, you see diseased individuals. They are inferior biologically. They are inferior spiritually. And we're going to get into the differences between us spiritually and physically. So once we began to look into melanin, look into what actually makes us biologically different, and we began confirming biologically, which we already knew spiritually, that they are inferior, then the next move that the White and Offspring made was to begin to promote this idea that there's no such thing as race. There's no biological basis for race. There's no genetic basis for race. This was a political move. And the White and Offspring began to push that because black people were beginning to realize and understand decades ago that actually white is inferior. So anybody who's not black, they're inferior to us. And we started realizing that and started teaching our children that and spreading that information. So they had to switch lanes. And now all of a sudden, there's no such thing as race. And then Negroes who work on behalf of the whites and offspring begin to propagate that in the community. And then black people in the community who, out of ignorance, who follow the whites and offspring, they begin to propagate that nonsense as well. So you have some people who are geneticists, biologists, you know, engineers, psychologists, psychiatrists, and so forth, neurologists. Some of them promote and propagate that misinformation that there's no biological basis for race because out of ignorance, they're following the white and offspring and they think they're being scientifically curious and intelligent. But then you have some of them who know it's inaccurate, but they're following the white and offspring because they hate themselves and they work on behalf of the whites and offspring. We always must make those delineations. We must understand that some people do things out of ignorance, but you always have this percentage of these individuals who know exactly what they're doing, but they work on behalf of our enemies, our absolute enemies, which are the whites and offspring. Just like the overseer on the plantation will whip the slaves, the enslaved, on behalf of the whites and offspring. The black so-called overseer would do that, even though he was getting raped and whipped by the white master. He didn't care because he still wanted to be the favorite of the white master. So after he got raped and whipped, he would turn around and whip the slaves. Instead of turning around and killing the white so-called master, he would rather whip on the enslaved for the white master just to be accepted to a certain extent. We have Negroes like that who used to be that, who have incarnated through their descendants, and they're walking around right now. And they're still working on behalf of the whites and their offspring. And then you have another large percentage of people who embrace the nonsense of the whites and offspring out of ignorance because they've been brainwashed that the whites and offspring are superior, so whatever they teach is true. So when their white scientists say there's no biological basis for race and they lay out their reasons for that, the black scientists just swallow all of that. They don't investigate it. They don't scrutinize it. They just swallow it and regurgitate it to the black community, and they believe that they're being mature, and they believe that they're being correct, but they're not. So politically, this is why the whites and offspring began to push that notion a number of decades ago that there's no biological basis for race, which of course they know that's inaccurate. They wanted to blur the line. Now you have black people who consider themselves cultural or nationalist and so forth, and they spout that nonsense as well. So then they can't tell the difference between, okay, well, who is black and who is not black, and who's in the race and who's not in the race, what is race and who are we, and so forth. Then you have Negroes who are working on behalf of the whites and their offspring trying to bring all kinds of, you know, non-black people into our culture and calling them family and saying, well, they're just, you know, they're really black, and Mexicans are really Africans, and they just don't know who they are, and, you know, all Hispanic people and all Latino people are really African people. That's pure nonsense. Asians are not African. Hispanics, white Hispanics and white Latinos and Latinas and so forth are not our people. Pseudo Native Americans are not our people and so forth. So we're going to define that. When they teach it has no biological basis, But at the same time, they give you the nigger treatment anyway. So you're trying to embrace that false doctrine they're promoting while they're still oppressing you based on your race, because they know race is real. When they teach that, and when we accept it, and we think we're being intelligent, we're being foolish, because what we're actually doing is we're accepting different forms of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Every time somebody tells you, they can define you based on their definitions of race, and they're telling you there's no biological basis for race, and identity is based on more so on culture than it is on biology. What they're doing is forcing you to accept Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And even though they're talking about quote-unquote science and they will call themselves atheists, and atheism is just another pseudo-religion of the white canal spring, it has nothing to do with our people. Our white canal spring cannot communicate with the great father and the great mother. They can't communicate with the deities. They can't communicate with the honorable ancestresses and ancestors of Afuraka, Afuraikai. They hate the fact that we can, and they hate the fact that they're inferior, so they don't want us to communicate and attune to the forces of divine order, because then we won't listen to them. So they promote this idea that there are no deities and that's all superstition. That was part of the process of trying to destroy our culture and our people. Atheism is just another fake religion that they propagate, and some Negroes embrace that now and think that's ancient Africa. But what they're teaching is, even though they claim to be atheists and quote-unquote scientific and things like that, what they're actually teaching is the same fake religion, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Because when we talk about identity in the real sense, you're talking about the Afurakani, Afuraikani individual who incarnates through a specific blood circle. Your identity is the spirit of the individual who existed before they even got into the womb. The identity starts there. And then you come through the womb and you come through a specific blood circle. And yes, you have specific blood ties to different groups. But the spirit, where does the spirit come from? What ancestral clan did that spirit come from? When the person made their transition and died and went to the ancestral realm, eventually they reincarnate generations later through a specific blood circle. What ancestral clan did they come from? Their race and what deities they are connected to and what specific ancestral language they are connected to, that encoded within their Kra, the Ka, the Kayat, the soul, the divine consciousness, called Okra and Okrawa and Akan, Ori, Inu, and Yoruba, and Selido and Vodun. That's where your identity comes from. So, for example, like we talked about before, somebody is living, if an individual is living as an Akan person a few hundred years ago and they make their transition in Kumasi in the Akan region 300 years ago, this is an Akan person connected to an Akan family who has specific characteristics. They also have specific deities that are connected to their blood circle that will possess them during their lifetime. They will pull out the patient to harmonize with the energy of those deities are flowing through their body and their spirit because they possess them and they did divination with them, did ritual with them and so forth. They're connected to certain divinities, connected to a certain group, a clan, and so forth. That individual dies, their body is buried, their spirit is in the ancestral realm. Their descendants, who are still living on earth, they have children, their children have children, their children have children. So that person who died is an ancestor now. He's one of the Nsamanfo. He's watching over his descendants. His descendants pour libation to him, do rituals, periodically go to the ancestral shrine, communicate with him. He visits them in a dream sometimes. He communicates with them during ritual practices or during the ancestral celebrations and maybe possesses somebody every now and then and speaks to the community when he's possessing the body of somebody through spirit possession. He's communicating with them generation after generation after generation. Eventually, generations down the line, when one of his descendants was forced into American enslavement and they've been having children in America for generations, seven or eight generations down, it's time for him to return to the world. So before he returns into a womb, he's drawn to Inyamewa Inyame, the great mother and the great father, Amenet, Amen, called Mawu and Lisa in Vodun, Komosu and Chuku in Igbo, for example. He's given a Kra, soul, a divine consciousness. Your soul or your Kra is a deity. It's a spirit force in creation. It's like a messenger of the supreme being. And Nyamewa, Nyamewa, Amenet, Amen, directs that deity, that force in nature, to take up residence in your spirit in the head region. Just like you have your body, you have a smaller body within your body which regulates all the functions of your body, which is your brain. Spirit, your sumsum, is your spirit body, and within the sumsum in the head region dwells your spirit's brain, which is the Akras, an entity. It's a divinity. It's a conscious divinity that dwells in the head region and communicates with you throughout your life, and you communicate with that divinity. And, of course, we have names for that divinity in our Akan culture. We are named after that divinity. Our Akrasin, our soul name, is based on that. So we communicate with that force in nature that dwells within us. Once that divinity is assigned to the spirit of the person by the supreme being, now they are a spirit and they have a Akra, they have a soul. Now they're a whole entity. It's like a body with a brain added to it. And now that's just a body and a brain, or a spirit body and a spirit brain. Now you're a whole entity. Now you can be sent into a womb to gestate. Your spirit will enter the womb when your descendant, one of your descendants, great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaughters who's married, copulates with her spouse, there's conception, the union of sperm and ovum, but then your spirit invests itself in that zygote, and you take up residence in her womb, and then 40 weeks later, you're born into the world for the first time in 300 years. Now, as you're growing up, ask your mother and father where you come from. They've been brainwashed in America about race, and they say, well, we've been mixed with so-called Native Americans, and there's some, the slave master raped their blood into the family, so we're mixed up, but, you know, we have some African in us, and we may have some Native American generations back, all this other blood mixture they will talk about, but they don't understand who they are. And when that person, the child, that ancestor who has returned, asks, well, who am I, who are we, where do we come from, the parents don't know. But as we say, in our Akwamu mind, in the Akwamu nation of North America, Wotumi Fra Moja Nso, Wotumi Fra Akra, you can mix blood, but you cannot mix the Akra, you cannot mix the soul. That individual, that ancestor, is the same Akan ancestor who lived in Kumasi 300 years ago, the same individual. He reincarnates through his descendants. He comes out. This time his body is a little bit lighter brown because of the pollution that took place during enslavement for hundreds of years and took place in America. However, he's still a melanin-dominant Afurakani man. Because even though there was pollution, the melanin won the physiological battle, or else he would be melanin recessive. So he's lighter brown than he would have been if there was no pollution. But he's the same Akan spirit. He's the same individual. He has a Kra, he has a soul of divine consciousness. And that's what distinguishes black people, Afurakani, Afurakaitni people, from all other groups of people on earth. We have a divinity that's assigned to us by the supreme being before we incarnate into the world that it dwells with us throughout our lives. Ancestral religion revolves around that divinity because that deity governs our lives. And when we listen to that force that's pulling us in our head to pull us in one direction or the other, it's always pulling us towards thoughts, intentions, and actions that are in harmony with divine order. When we align ourselves with that force, that divinity, and when we have a good relationship, we can communicate with that divinity, and that divinity communicates with us. We can see that divinity, and it will show itself to us, manifest itself to us. But when we align with that divinity, we're engaged in spiritual alignment, harmony with order. When we get out of harmony with alignment with that divinity, then our ancestors and ancestors show us specific things we can do to get back in harmony with order. The Abosom, the forces of nature, they empower us to get back in harmony with order so we can execute our function in the world. We are assigned a divinity, an Okra, or Okrawa in Akan culture, an Ori Inu in the Yoruba tradition, a Selido in the Vodun tradition, an Oka or Kaet in ancient Kemet, a Chi in the Igbo tradition. We're given that divinity, and we have that. The whites and their offspring do not have that. They are spirits of disorder. Why are they spirits of disorder? Because they don't have an anchor in divine order. They don't have a Kra, a soul of divine consciousness. They're like a chicken with its head cut off, running amok. They're like a body without a brain. They are spirits without souls, and therefore their spirits are degenerate. They're corrupt. They're disordered. They're discordant. They're spirits of disorder. Now, how did it come to be that they were like us? So first of all, that's what distinguishes us from every other group on the continent. We incarnate with a kra, a soul, the divine conscious. They incarnate without one. And, of course, their outer, you know, body manifests that disorder, so they manifest, of course, spiritually deficient, physiologically deficient, unless they begin to mix racially with other people, and then their outer form becomes light brown when they have a lot of children and so forth. But when their spirits enter those melanin-dominant bodies, they are still spirits without a crop, without a soul, divine consciousness, and now they're just wolves in sheep's clothing. Now they're just spirits of disorder operating through light brown bodies now. So we're going to get into that. But first we're going to get into how did they come to be that way. We know, just dealing with true story and dealing with archaeology and things like that, that Afurakani, Afurakani people began in Afuraka, Afurakai. We migrated around the world. We migrated up into southern Europe tens of thousands of years ago. Of course, some people got caught up in northern Eurasia during the last ice age. Those individuals were cut off from the larger population. And then eventually about 12,000 plus years ago when the ice really began to melt and they were able to move around again, those individuals coming out of northern Eurasia, spilling into southern Europe, spilling into the Levant, spilling into later on into Asia in the east, China and so forth, and then eventually coming in contact with us, waging war against us, trying to dominate us, like we talked about earlier. Of course, they typically were unsuccessful. It took them thousands of years to finally gain some control in certain areas. When they separate, so this is just basic true story, and archaeology, of course, bears that out, and genetic studies with the human genome bear that out as well. So when we're talking about people migrating around the world, whites and their offspring, whether they're Europeans and Asians. Of course, Europe and Asia is one continent, Eurasian. And then you'll find the pseudo-Native Americans, just Asians who migrated and invaded this part of the world after black people were already here. If you look at the genetic footprint of the Eurasian, whether it's the pseudo-Native Americans, Asians, and Europeans, they all share the same ancestry. Genetically, they're fundamentally the same group, and they are separate from us. Now, that's borne out genetically, that's borne out through archaeology, that's borne out just through true story and so forth. The key is, why did the group separate? Why did one black group separate and go up into northern Eurasia as opposed to staying connected with the other Afurakani, Afurakaiti people? In our culture, of course, we understand that because we have an oral truth story. In the Kukutunsum, the ancestral jurisdiction, we go into that. We talk about how those engaged in disorder, perversity, just like you have one out of every 100,000 cells in your body right now, at any given time, is cancerous for everybody. The reason why everybody's not dying of cancer, of course, is because those cells develop, but then you have an immune system that isolates those cells, kills them, and expels them from the body to maintain the integrity of your form. So even though cancerous cells, they were once normal, they were once just as healthy as the other cells, looked like the other cells, functioned as the other cell, but they began to engage in disordered activity. They become disfigured. They don't look like the other cells anymore. They don't function as the other cells anymore. In fact, all they seek to do now, because they're disfigured, is to consume and destroy all of the other cells. And if their development is not arrested, they will consume and proliferate and spread throughout the whole body and destroy the entire body, totally, including themselves. That's the whites and their offspring. Less than one out of every 100,000 black people, that very small percentage, became cancerous, became disfigured in their thoughts, intentions, and behavior. Just like those cells become wayward and began to attack the other cells and become disfigured, and then they reproduce and produce cancerous cells, and they begin to proliferate. So when individuals like that in the community, we always have you know, methods to deal with those individuals in the community. You have people in the community, and all of a sudden you have a very small percentage of people, one or two people start acting crazy, engaging in disordered behavior, theft, or something more worse than theft, like murder, or rape, or molestation, or dissexuality, homosexuality. We have remedies for that. We kill those individuals. We've always done that for thousands of years, and even up until today in certain areas, whether it's in this part of the world, or Afuraka, Afraikai, people who are murderers, people who are rapists, dissexuals, homosexuals, engage in that filthy, degenerate behavior, we typically will kill those individuals. That's why the incidence of murder and rape and child molestation is so low, almost non-existent for years in the community. You go 30, 40 years and nobody's ever been murdered. Nobody's been molested, none of that stuff. That's a common thing in our traditional cultures, traditional society, and even when we get over here and we get amongst ourselves in this part of the world, once black people are around themselves, you can live in certain black communities and murder and things like that. It's so unheard of that when it happens once in years, people are so shocked because they say, well, in our community, that just doesn't happen. Now, of course, because of the white narrow spring and crack cocaine and enforcing that in our communities and brainwashing our people through corrupted hip-hop and other music and other, and dissexuality, of course, they're, you know, promoting that nonsense and violence and self-hatred and everything else in our people, and we start engaging in that kind of behavior, which is actually white behavior. But typically, that's not the kind of behavior we would engage in. That's the kind of behavior the whites in our offspring engage in. Typically, we had answers for that. We would kill such individuals, or they would be exiled because they would escape that killing, and they would escape and separate from the larger group. People who engage in theft, you know, abuse and things like that, you know, the ones who didn't get killed and got caught up, some of them escaped, got away from the larger population. They wouldn't be allowed. If they came back to the population, they would get killed, so they wouldn't come back. They would exile themselves. This is thousands of years ago, even on the continent now, in rural areas. People get banished and so forth. If they come back, they will be killed, so they stay away and they reestablish a little village somewhere else further away, and they stay away for the rest of their lives. People who got away from the killing, the execution of justice, they escaped further away. Some of them would have children. Some of them, you know, recognize they made a huge mistake, and maybe their children and grandchildren, when they grow up and they were isolated away from the larger population, they will want to return. They will want to reconnect with their family members who were part of the larger population, and they would return. The other people would die in that exiled wilderness and so forth. Typically, when things like that would happen, we learn things from that. We learn valuable lessons from that. People don't want to be separated from the larger group. They don't want to be separated from the protection of the larger group. So we have proverbial wisdom, divine wisdom teachings that all encompass that. Those individuals who continued in their perversity, specifically the ones engaged in dissexuality, homosexuality, rape, murder, that kind of thing, those who escaped that killing and exiled themselves, those people were, as we say in the Kukulcum, drawn up into northern Eurasia. And what, of course, later on, they got caught up in the Ice Age. We say drawn into northern Eurasia. Now we're talking about the reasons why people migrated. We know archaeologically they migrated. We know just studying the human genome, they migrated, and they ended up in certain areas, and there are artifacts that are left behind. Why did they migrate? Why were they repelled? Because of their behavior. Just like the cancerous cells, because of their behavior, they're isolated from the rest of the cells, and they're killed because of their behavior. Because of their corrupt behavior, perverse behavior, they're repelled from the larger society, so they're forced and drawn into northern Eurasia. If you look at the proper orientation of the globe, south is up and north is down, west is to the right, east is to the left. And that's why we gain our orientation, and many authors have talked about that in ancient Kemet. If you're facing south, then to the right is also the westerly direction, and the east is also, the left is also the easterly direction. So that's why the word for right in Kemet is the same word for west, which is Amit, and the word for left, Apet, is also the word for east. Because when we orient ourselves toward the south, toward the front land, the first land, Kanat, the Kanit land, ancient Nubia, the front land, the first land, that is our orientation. That's our origin. So we face south to gain our orientation. And right is left, west. I'm sorry, right is west and east, left. So when you have that proper orientation, you recognize that when the quote-unquote continent is up, right side up, in reality, where the south, Afuraka, Afuraka, is at the top, and, you know, the large bulging port of the portion of the continent is at the bottom, now you see it represents and looks very similar to a human heart. And then when you look at the other continents in relationship to it and their position, you see that they are connected to the major organs in the body. So when you look at it that way, and you see the large bulging portion at the bottom, so that's the northern portion, but it's at the bottom. Then right further south of that is Eurasia, which is the largest landmass. But then just adjacent to the heart in the body is the liver, which is the largest organ. And it's in a similar shape to Eurasia in relationship to Afuraka, Afuraka. And that's just Eurasia in general. But then just north of that, you'll find the small intestine. That's northern Eurasia. So when we talk about, of course, we are born in Afuraka, Afuraka, in the heartland. We talk about those individuals who became engaged in perverse behavior, engaged taking the life force energy and creation, the energy of Ra and Ra'at, and corrupting that, and engaging in dissexuality, homosexuality, and other corruptions. Then they're drawn into northern Eurasia. We would kill those individuals. Some of them escape, and then they're drawn into northern Eurasia. They're drawn into the small intestine region of the planet, the waste processing region of the planet. They get caught up in the Ice Age, and at the end of the Ice Age, because of inbreeding, which greatly increases the incidence of albinism, and, of course, the autoimmune disease, vitiligo, where the albatum melanin is stripped from the body, now you have albino types, people with extra vitiligo characteristics with their melanin abatum stripped from them. Of course, they were had diminished sunlight. Of course, their diet would corrupt them, but it was that inbreeding and engaging in corrupt behavior where they lost their crop. They go in as black people who had a crop. You engage in perverse behavior. Your akra, your soul, your divine consciousness, which is a deity. And just like all other deities are embodiments of divine order, that divinity will leave you if you're engaged in disorder on a consistent basis. Just like you have two magnets on a table and the light polarities are facing, they will repel one another without touching. If you engage in disorder on a consistent basis, your kra, your soul, divine consciousness will disengage from your body and separate from you. And if you continue in that disorder, it will return to Inyamewa Inyame, or Mawu and Lisa, Amenet Amen, and will dissolve back into the great Ka and Kaya, the great divine soul, divine consciousness, just like a drop of water returning to the ocean. And once that drop returns to the ocean and is dissolved back into the ocean, then you will never find that drop again. If your cross disengages from you, that spiritual force separates from your head region and returns to Inyamewa Inyame. Now you are a spirit without a cross. You are a spirit without a divine anchor in divine order, without a force that's always pulling you in harmony with divine order. Now you're just a wayward spirit that can be pulled in different directions, and those lusts and conditionings and perversions that you've internalized, now you operate an obsession. You operate based on that because you have no divine anchor within you that guides you towards divine order because you repelled it consistently. And now you're a spirit of disorder that's slated for destruction, just like a cancerous cell is slated for destruction. So that's how black people spiritually engaged in disorder become cancerous cells in the body of black humanity. Their cry repels from them forever. Now, the average person, you can engage in disordered activity like stealing or, you know, drug use and all kinds of nonsense, lying to people and stuff like that, your crop will disengage from you. It'll still be around you, but it will disengage from you. And then there are rites and rituals where the Akan will say, Nekra, Driane, his crop has fled from him. And they will engage in ritual processes to draw that divinity back to re-engage and reinstall itself in the head of the individual. The same is true in the Yoruba tradition. The same is true in the Vodun tradition. The Seilido in the Vodun tradition, the Sei can disengage from the person and separate from the person. And in Vodou, they would say the person is like a living, a walking corpse, unless that deity is drawn back ritually. The Ori can disengage from you. We're not talking about when in the Odu they talk about Ori is the only deity that will never leave you. That's true if you live in harmony with the Ori. And that specific Odu in that instance is talking about that's your primary divinity, that all of your spirituality revolves around that divinity, your Ori. That's what that Odu in that particular instance is talking about. It's not talking about the fact that if you engage in disorder, your Ori can disengage from you. It's talking about the Ori in relationship in comparison to other Orisha, because the Ori is an Orisha in and of itself, or Irumoli in and of itself. It's saying in comparison to the other Orisha, that's the one that's with you the whole time, because your Nkra, Nkrabia, your divine function, which in Yoruba they would call the Ayanmo and so forth, different aspects of that, your destiny, your divine function is encoded within the Ori, so it will never leave you in that sense. But if you engage in disorder, then it will separate from you. So that's across the board in Apuraka, Apuraka, and wherever we migrate in the world. We know these facts because we engage these divinities. This has been true for thousands of years. It's true today. So we know the difference. We know, just like we talked about identity, we communicate with our ancestresses and ancestors. We know who they are. So for some Negro geneticist or some Negro biologist or some Negro neurologist or neurosurgeon or Negro psychiatrist who's just aping the nonsense of the whites and their offspring and thinking they're being scientific, all they're doing is embracing Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, because Christianity, Islam, and Judaism deliberately wrote reincarnation and ancestral communication out of their fake religions, because they understood that if we listened to our ancestresses and ancestors, we wouldn't listen to the whites and offspring. We would actually execute them. So they can't have us pouring libation. You can invade a country and dominate politically, and then people can go into their house and pour libation, and the deities that are connected to them and their ancestresses and ancestors will tell them, go kill the people who just invaded the country, you'll never be able to maintain control. But if you can corrupt the religion and tell people it's an abomination to communicate with the dead, and it's an abomination to communicate with other deities, and there are no other deities but the one God, and that fake God is represented on earth by the whites, if you can teach a fake doctrine like that, then the people, if they're foolish, will stop listening to their ancestresses and ancestors who walk with them every day, will stop listening to the deities who are connected to them by blood, and they will only listen to the whites and their offspring. And if a deity does communicate with them or show up in a dream or possess them, the person will say, oh, no, that was a demonic spirit. I'm not going to listen to anything they say, and whatever they tell me to do, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do the opposite. That's what the whites and their offspring had to promote through Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. They also had to promote a false idea that reincarnation was not real. That way you don't understand your identity. You think you only have one life. You don't realize that you're going to return, and you don't know who you are. You don't know what ancestral clan you were in the previous lifetime. You can't identify that again when you lose the knowledge of reincarnation. So that's political. But we communicate with our ancestors and ancestors. They speak to us in our ancestral languages, even when we don't know the language. And then when we go study the information they told us at the shrine or through possession, or in a dream or whatever, we study the languages and find out the things that they were saying at the shrine or in possession. We find all those words in the dictionaries of the language that they were speaking. They speak directly to us. They show us things that have happened, that will happen. They teach us how to heal. They do various different things. They show us how to do divination, to communicate, show us things that are happening in other people's lives through divination. And when we share those things with those individuals and the people, say you're right on point. So, for example, we do divination for someone here, and that person actually lives on another continent, and we can see what's actually going on in their house, and we can identify those things, and the person confirms it, even though we've never met. That's the Nsamanfo, the Abosom, the ancestresses and ancestors, and the Abosom actually communicating with us and showing us. So we have experiential knowledge of who the Insumafo are, who the Abosom are, who the Supreme Being is, Great Mother and Great Father. We know our identity. We can identify that. We can identify who reincarnated, who came back into the blood circle. Where did they come from? What deity is over their head? We can see that divinity. We can communicate with that divinity. We can find out exactly who the individual is. So we have knowledge. A Negro scientist doesn't have that knowledge because they're aping the nonsense of the inferior whites and their offspring, the Achiwadipo spirits of disorder. So we have knowledge of that. So when we get back to individuals who lose their kra, their soul, their divine consciousness, then they go up. Those are the ones, those black people who did that. And as we were saying, an individual just on a daily basis, when you engage in disorder, you can repel your kra to a certain extent. And there are a few things that can happen. If you're engaging in theft and nonsense and lying and drug use and other kinds of foolish behavior, you become repulsive to that embodiment of divine order. Your kra, the divinity, is not going to dwell in disorder. Just like if somebody left fecal matter in your house, you're not going to just sit around. You don't have to dwell in filth. And your kra is not going to dwell in your spirit while you're engaged in consistent disorder. Not out of ignorance, but you're deliberately engaging in it. If you're engaged in things out of ignorance, of course, your kra will remain with you and teach you what you need to learn. But if you're deliberately going against your kra, you have reversed your polarity, and now you're like the magnet that's repelling the other magnet across the table without touching. You become repulsive to your kra, and it disengages from your head, literally. And if somebody's clairvoyant, they can see that force outside of your head instead of being firmly placed within your head. So a few things can happen. Either you will die when the kra separates like that. You will start manifesting spiritual discordance or dime madness, as we call it in our con, but in English would be manifest in various forms like major depressive disorder, schizoaffective disorder, paranoid schizophrenia, bipolar 1, bipolar 2, these various axis 1 diagnoses or anxiety disorders and various things. They will manifest in that fashion. Because your kra, that anchored in divine order, is separate. Sometimes trauma in and of itself will cause the kra to separate to a certain extent, but it will still be with you. So people will just totally disconnect. They will manifest so-called mental illnesses. And really all they need is spiritual realignment with their Insumafo. They don't need these psychotropic medications, which actually cause more harm physiologically than anything else. So just people engage in disorder to a certain extent, you can cause that to happen. But if you're consistent with it and you're deliberate with it, then your kra, like we said before, will totally disengage, go back to Inyame wa Inyame and dissolve within the great Kai and Kayat. And then now you're a spirit without a soul. You are now a spirit of disorder. Your behavior manifests that, of course, and expresses that. And now you will engage that kind of behavior and you become what they would call antisocial personality disorder and things like that. This is what happened with those black people who engaged in dissexuality, homosexuality, criminality, murder, rape, and so forth, molestation. Those are the kinds of individuals who became cancerous, the kra disengaged. So, of course, those we would kill those individuals, but some escaped, exiled themselves, but they were drawn into northern Eurasia, the waste processing plant of the part of the planet. They later get caught up in the ice age, but they were drawn into that region, and they lost their pigmentation in that region. They engaged in incest. That's one of the reasons they got exiled, and they were being chased out, hunted, because they were engaged in that filth, incest, and dissexuality. They continued that practice, and the increase in albinism is in common measure commensurate with the practice of incest. And then, of course, the autoimmune disease, vitiligo, which is stripping the melanin. So they went to the northern Eurasia as spirits of disorder. The Okra had already disengaged from them. And once the Okra leaves you, then eventually that seat of the Okra, which is crests in the brain, that neuromelanin, that black substance that's all throughout your body and culminates and apexes in the brain, once your cry leaves, then eventually that sacred black chemical leaves as well. And now you are a white-skinned, internally and externally individual. Light skin, light hair, blonde hair, light eyes, and so forth. These are spirits without a cry, and eventually, physiologically, that spiritual disfigurement manifested physiologically. It manifested on one hand because they engaged in incest, engaged in, you know, negative behavior, perverse behavior, but of course, it was their behavior that led them to that region in the first place. They wouldn't have been in that region if it wasn't because of their behavior. And they were drawn into that region. They get caught up in the ice age, their diet changes, of course, and that affects them negatively as well. But it's that incest, inbreeding, corrupt behavior that leads to that deep pigmentation in a major way. Now, we talk about that. That's part of the oral tradition of Afurakani, Afurakaidi people. You'll find in different groups, even the ones who have been brainwashed by the whites and their offspring and embraced Islam or embraced Christianity to a certain extent, when you talk about the oral traditions of the people and they'll claim, oh, I'm a Christian and I don't believe in that, or I'm a Muslim, I don't believe in that, but when you get them in a real conversation, they will reveal some of the oral tradition and they will tell you, well, you know, actually, my grandmothers and grandfathers always said that white people are actually, what we say in English, spirits of this order, or they would say devils, you know, demonic spirits, meaning spirits of disorder, not extraterrestrials coming from anywhere else. Of course, that's white nonsense as well, so we don't get caught up in that foolishness like a lot of Negroes do. But when we talk about spirits of disorder, demonic spirits, is just that's just an English way of saying it, but when you say demonic, then that ties people to the Bible and all of the notions of foolishness that were we have internalized from the whites and our offspring. But the individuals will tell you, part of their oral tradition is these individuals are spirits of disorder, and whatever terminology they use in their language to identify them as that, they use that terminology. But what they're talking about is exactly what we're explicating here, trying to use these English words to designate these achiwadiefo, or spirits of disorder. So that's all across the continent. Sometimes it takes a minute. Well, and you come in contact with people who are here in the West who come from the continent. Sometimes it takes a minute to break through and for them to actually reveal their actual oral traditions because they're scared to say something about it because they've been brainwashed to think their oral traditions and traditional culture is inferior and primitive. But if you get in a good conversation, you'll find that out. But if you can find that out from your own Nananom Nsamampo as well. You can also, of course, find out from your own elders and elderesses as well because we have that same oral tradition even in North America. We recognize that these white people who enslaved us and everything else, they are different from us. They're not the same. Their spirits are different. Their spirits are evil. And your grandmothers and great-grandfathers will tell you the same thing. They'll use English words to describe what we've been describing for thousands of years all along. We know the nature of the spirit of these individuals because we can peer into the nature and construction of their corrupted spirits and see who they are. We can witness that. So we know who they are. We have investigative tools of forensic spirituality, which are oracular systems, various forms of divination, some using implements, some using different aspects of our own spiritual anatomy to be able to see into and attune to these spirits of disorder. We can do that, our children can do that, and that's a skill that we teach our children so they can attune and know the difference between a spirit of disorder and a spirit of order. An Afurakani, Afurakaidi person and a white individual, whether they're white, Hispanic, European, American, Arab, Asian, Hindu, whatever they are. So they never are confused. Even if one of the whites in our offspring starts talking nice to them and being nice and so forth, or if they see a white baby in a stroller, they can attune to the spirit of that baby or the other white individual and feel the discord and perverse energy emanating from that individual before they even speak, before they even engage in any kind of behavior. So their little plays of nice behavior doesn't fool the individual who's in harmony with order. So let's get into a specific text that actually talks about that, and then we're going to talk about some texts from ancient Kemet that deals specifically with race, skin color, and the differences in character based on skin color. So for the Negroes who try to say that we didn't have any notion of race until the 1800s when the Europeans started creating race as a social construct and all that foolishness that Negroes repeat, actually in ancient Kemet they were talking about race. In the Great Hymn to the Aten, Akhenaten talks about the differences in skin color as it relates to people's character. So we're going to get into that. But first, let's read from our Emergence of Sekhmet. Emergence of Sekhmet. And we have that link. Hold on one second. And we placed that link up in the chat room so people can see that. And, of course, if anybody has any questions or comments, you can put them in the chat room. You can hit the number 1 on your phone to raise your hand so we can call on you. So, but first we're going to get into this, the emergence of Sekhmet. What we did was we took a portion of what is called the Book of the Cow of Heaven or the Destruction of Mankind, often text from ancient Kemet. What we did was we translated the portion talking about Sekhmet or Sechima, the lioness, goddess, the warrioress, goddess, divinity. From the Book of the Heavenly Cow, found in the tombs of Tutankhamen, Seti, Ramesu. So we did this particular portion because we were doing articles on Sechima and Sekhmet, and we wanted to show her emergence and specific things regarding that. But inside that, we want to show her birth, as a matter of fact, and how she came into being and what she was doing. But we also, in the context of that text, they talk about that oral tradition that many people have overlooked in that text. So we're going to read that portion, or we're going to read certain segments of it. We're not going to read the whole thing. So it starts off, Ra, the creator, the Ntoro, the divinity who brought himself into being. It happened that after he had assumed the sovereignty over men and women, Ntoru, deities, goddesses, and gods in creation, certain men and women were speaking words of complaint against Ra, and they were saying, look, his majesty has grown old, his bones have become like silver, his members like gold, and his hair is like real lapis lazuli. His majesty, talking about Ra, heard the words of complaint which these men and women were speaking. His majesty said to those who were in his following, come, bring to me my Arit, meaning my eye, which is the name of the female divinity, and Shu, and Tefnut, and Seb, and Nut, and the fathers and mothers who were with me when I was in Nu, together with my father, the Ntoru, Nu, the god Nu. Let him bring his counselors with him. Let them be brought together in secret so that those men and women may not perceive them and therefore take to flight with their hearts in fear. You come with them to the great house and let them declare their counsel fully, for I will go to Nu, into the place wherein I brought about my own existence. So let these divinities be brought to me there. And then it says the deities were drawn up on both sides of Ra. They bowed down before his majesty until their heads touched the ground. And the creator of men and women, the sovereign of the Rakit, spoke his words in the presence of his father, Nu, the father of the firstborn, Ntoru, Ntorotu, and spoke in the presence of his majesty, Ra. And Nu spoke to his son, Ra, and said, speak to us, we are listening to your word. Then Ra spoke to his father, Nu, you, firstborn, Ntoro, from whom I came into being. And then the other Ntoru, Ntorotu, goddesses and gods of ancient time, my ancestresses and ancestors, my first ones, listen to these men and women who are created by my Arit, my eye, who are speaking words, plotting rebellion against me. Tell me what you would do in the matter. Consider this thing for me and seek out a plan for me, for I will not slay them until I have heard what you say to me concerning it. Then the majesty of Nu spoke to his son Ra. You are the Ntoro, the god who is greater than he who made you. You are the sovereign of those who were created with you. Your throne is set, and the fear of you is great. Let your Arit, your eye, go against those who are rebelling, who are uttering blasphemies against you, and who are plotting to rebel against you. And the majesty of Ra said, look, they have taken to flight into the mountain lands, for their hearts are afraid because of the words of rebellion which they have spoken. Now that's key. And then next it says, then the Ntoru and Ntorotu, the goddesses and gods, spoke in the presence of his majesty, saying, let your Arit, your eye, go forth, and let her destroy for you those who, why you in two, rebel in disorder. For there is no Arit whatsoever, or eye whatsoever, that can go before her and resist her when she journeys in the form of the Ntoru Hetheru. The Ntoru, or goddess, then went forth and slaughtered the men and women who were on the mountain, the desert land. And the majesty of Ra said, come, come in peace, Hetheru, for the work is accomplished. Then the goddess said, you have made me to live. And when I, Sekhem Na, executed Sekhem of power over the rebellious men and women, it was sweet to my heart. And then the next portion says, and the majesty of Ra said, I will execute authority over them as king, and I will destroy them. And so it happened that this Sekhmet, this powerful one, this goddess Sekhmet, upon the change of night, waded about in the blood of the men and the women she had slaughtered, beginning in the region of Henin Su. Now, in fact, we don't even have to go further than that. So there are many key things that were brought up in that section. Men and women, certain men and women plotting to rebel against Ra. At the end of the text, by the way, once they killed men and women, in fact, let me read that section before we even get into the analysis of it, because that's a good piece. There are certain things that were done, Ra dealing with the divinities and so forth, and further near the end, and when these things had been done, the good men and women saw the Ntoro Ra upon the back of Nut, the goddess Nut in the sky, in the form of a divine cow. Then these men and women said, remain with us, and we will overthrow your enemies who speak words of blasphemy and plot rebellion against you, and we will destroy them. And eventually Ra says, your acts of violence are placed behind you, for the slaughtering of enemies is above the slaughter of sacrifice. So what happens is some of the men and women were killed by Sekhmet. Many of them, she took the form of that sacred lion. She was, after she slaughtered them, massacred them, she was wading in their blood because she loved the fact that she was massacring them, and she said it was sweet to her heart. Now, eventually, all of them were not killed. So a section of the text also says, after Roth asked Sekhmet, okay, calm down, you've killed them, relax, come in peace. He calls her Amit, which means the beautiful, gracious one, and so forth. And then he says to her, and the majesty of Ra says, to this Ntorot goddess, a feeling of the heat of melancholy has come over me. From where does this feeling come? The majesty of Ra said, I live, but my heart has become exceedingly weary with the existence of them, meaning the disordered men and women. I have slain some of them, but there is a remnant of worthless ones, for the destruction which I exacted upon them was not as great as my power. Now, let's get into the text. The analysis is this, and the key points are this. Certain men and women started rebelling against Ra, plotting rebellion. Yu means rebelling, rebelliousness, in true meaning, rebelling in disorder or evil, and they're referred to as that. Ra calls his father Nu and the deities that were in the realm of Nun and Nunet with him, which he refers to as his first ones or his ancestresses and ancestors. He calls them into a council and says, listen, these rebellious men and women are trying to overthrow me, meaning they're trying to project disordered energy into the life force of creation. Before I slay them, I want to ask what you would do first. I will not slay them until I hear from you. So the creator of the universe, just like Ra is the creator, Ra is the creatress. The creator of the universe first goes to his ancestors and ancestresses and asks for their counsel before he makes a decision. if the creator of the universe and the creatress of the universe can go to their ancestresses and ancestors for counsel, their elders and eldresses, their nananon mpanyifo, their spiritually cultivated elders and eldresses, then of course we do the same thing. Recall, as we taught in the previous webcast, the Supreme Being, Amenet and Amen, are the grandparents of Ra and Ra'et. So the Supreme Being are different from the Creator and Creatress. The Creator and Creatress, Ra and Ra'et, serve the Supreme Being, so there's a difference. Whites and their offspring don't delineate that difference, of course, and Negroes who embrace the nonsense of the whites and their offspring have infected ancestral religion by trying to say that we are monotheistic and the Supreme Being and the Creator is all the same thing. They don't know what they're talking about. Whether they're initiated or not, it doesn't matter. They're dealing with an infection of the culture. And, of course, we demonstrated that clearly. So the Creator and Creatress, the Creator here in this story, consults with his father and his elders and eldresses, his ancestresses and ancestors. His father tells him, listen, your throne is set. You are one who is greater than he who made you. Send Sekhmet in the form of Hereru, your eye. Ari means eye. Ari Ra means the eye of Ra. So many divinities, female divinities, are called the eye of Ra, the divinity, the circular serpent on the head of the divinity, takes on that title sometimes. Nobody can withstand her power. So he sends Sekhmet out. She comes out from his eye, comes out, and destroys and massacres those men and women as she begins to wade in their blood because it was so fun for her and it was sweet to her and she loved it. So much so that in the story, Ra has to have, you know, beer mixed in with the blood, with the river, to make it seem like it's blood, so that Sekhmet, when she goes and drinks the water at the river and she thinks she's drinking blood, she's actually drinking some beer mixed with blood, and then she falls asleep and she doesn't kill anybody else because, you know, in the story, they didn't want her to begin to kill everything, like not only killing the disordered men and women, but killing everything. So they want to slow her down. And that's just part of the story. What it's really saying is just like your immune system cells, they kill disordered cells. Sometimes people have an overproliferation of immune system cells, and they begin to attack the healthy cells, and people develop different kinds of diseases because of that. So you don't want the immune system cells to begin to attack the healthy cells. That's a rare condition. This text is showing you how to avoid that and how that can possibly happen on a mundane level. But this is dealing with the deities and the spiritual level as well and people who are children of these divinities. So she's slowed down and everything, and then he says, I'm tired of these disordered men and women. I'm sick of them. And then they say, he said, I live, but my heart has become exceedingly weary with the existence of them. I have slain some of them, but there is a remnant of worthless ones, for the destruction which I exacted upon them was not as great as my power. Now let's go back further up into the earlier part of the text when he first witnessed these disordered men and women plotting rebellion, and he says, hey, we need to call a council because look at what they're doing. And as they're having the council and describing what they're going to do, and Nu says, hey, you need to send Sekhmet to kill these men and women. First he says, let's have the council, let them, you know, the council be brought together in secret so these men and women may not perceive them and therefore take the flight with their hearts in fear. They convene the council. Nu is there. The other divinities are there. Ra says, let me know what's going on. I want to make a decision, but I want your counsel first, your wise counsel first. Nu says, hey, you need to go ahead, send Sekhmet after them, and so forth. And after they have that discussion, and Nu and deity say, let your arit, or your eye, go against those who plot rebellion against you. Again, we say, and the majesty of Ra said, look, they have taken to flight into the mountain lands, for their hearts are afraid because of the words of rebellion which they have spoken. You had black people again who were engaged in disorder, Wayu rebellion. Their cry has separated from them. They're like cancerous cells in the body of black humanity, They're disordered. They're polluting the life force energies, Ra and Ra'at, in the body just like cancerous cells do. They're attacking the others. And this is happening on Earth, of course. Of course, we talked about the exile. We separate ourselves from those individuals. We typically kill them, but some of them separate. Ra recognizes that these individuals are engaged in that. And he says, look, they have taken to flight into the mountain lands, for their hearts are afraid because of the words of rebellion which they have spoken. He sends Sechima Sekhmet after them. She goes and slaughters them, massacres them. However, you go back further down into the text, and the key reading there says, and let me just read it one more time so you can get the gravity of the situation. It says, I have slain some of them, but my destruction, the destruction that I exacted upon them was not in concert with the extent of my power. Some of them still remain. Sekhmet slaughtered them, but there were some who still remained. And when he said, look, they have taken to flight into the mountain lands, the foreign lands, away from the rest of the population. This particular text is talking about those men and women who are engaged in disorder against divine order. And later in the text, of course, when you read through it, it talks about Ra sanctioning the good men and women to take up their bows and their weapons and to go and kill the rest of those individuals. And that sanction, given divine sanction, is divine order. He said the killing of the criminals, the slaughter of the enemies, is above the slaughter of sacrifice. So he sanctions that killing, divine hate, divine killing. This particular story is showing those disordered men and women who engage in disorder, polluting the life force, the same life force energy that we utilize in our procreative capacity to create children. They corrupt that through perverse sexual practices, dissexuality, homosexuality, molestation, inbreeding, incest, and so forth. They're polluting the life force energy, attacking, quote-unquote, Ra. He sends Sechima to go and kill them, but then some of them, he says there's a worthless remnant of them. He did not destroy all of them. So, and let's just read that section one more time so people can get that piece. Right. So it says, I have slain some of them, but there is a remnant of worthless ones, for the destruction which I exacted upon them was not as great as my power. So that remnant of worthless ones that had taken to flight into the mountain lands, when you see the medut or the determinative in Kemet with the mountain, it's talking about the foreign lands, taking flight into the foreign lands or the mountain lands. It was a remnant of worthless ones that didn't get caught. That's the remnant were taken up into the mountains of the Caucasus Mountains and so forth, into northern Eurasia. Those are the ones who later got caught up in the Ice Age and would become the whites and their offspring. But these are spirits of disorder, ones who have repelled their cry, drawn up into that region, and so forth. That same oral tradition from ancient Kemet, that when you talk to people and when you study even from your own Nsamampo, your ancestors and ancestors, and even connecting with those who are from the continent now, when you get them into conversations about their oral traditions, that same thread runs through the same tradition, that same ancient tradition of those who were exiled against the divine order with spirits of disorder without souls, those are the ones who became the whites and their offspring. This is the foundational text that shows that that's part of our oral tradition. And of course, we wrote it out. Now, let's get to another text. Let's get to the great hymn to the Aten. And we're going to read through that. In fact, no, let's look at the text from Plutarch, for example, in late Kemet. At the end of the dynasty, the Greek Plutarch writing about Osan or Set, calling them Osiris and Isis, talking about Set, what they call Typhon, comes from a corruption of Tepha in ancient Kemet, which is the title of Set, and they said Tepha or Tephon, a Typhon, a Typhon. And they're talking about Set, and there's something they're saying about SET and what it is. They say in one section, Plutarch is saying, he's talking about the Egyptians. He's trying to talk about their culture and what they mean by the deities and what they're doing and all this other stuff. He says, and because the Egyptians are of opinion that Typhon, meaning Set, was born of a red complexion, they are therefore used to devote to him such of the neat kind as they find to be of a red color. And their observation herein is so nice and strict that if they perceive the beast, and they're talking about sacrificing a specific kind of beast, because they say that, he says, the Egyptians are of the opinion that Typhon or Set was born of a red complexion, then they devote to him, talking about a sacrificial animal of the neat kind as they find to be of a red color. And their observation herein is so very nice and strict that if they perceive the beast, hold on 1 second, let me scroll back up with that, to have but one hair about it that is either black or white, they account it unfit for sacrifice. That's one section dealing with Typhon and his color. Here's another section that deals with Typhon and his skin color. We talk about a red complexion of Set. They believe, moreover, that the ass suffers for being like him, talking about Set, as hath been already spoken of, as much for the stupidity and sensualness of his disposition as for the redness of his color. So they're talking about the skin color of Set, also associated with sensualness, stupidity, and so forth. And even when they sacrifice certain animals, they look for the ones who are red because it has to do with, you know, the skin color. One more section we want to get to. Here it is right here. He says, but the power of Typhon, meaning Set, being much obscured and weakened, and himself besides in great dejection of mind and in agony, and as it were, at the last grasp, they therefore one while use certain sacrifices to comfort and appease his mind, and another while, again, have certain solemnities where they abase and affront him, talking about Set both by mishandling and abusing such men as they find to have red hair, and by breaking the neck of an ass down a precipice, as do the Coptites, because Typhon was red-haired and of the ass's complexion. So men who had red hair and reddish complexions, talking about the whites and the offspring with their ruddy or red complexions, with the red hair that looked like Set's hair, then they would abase and affront and mishandle and abuse those individuals with reddish skin and red hair because of who they are, because they had if they had red hair and reddish skin, they would tend to have the same negative characteristics associated with Set at that late period of Kemet, and then they would abase, abuse, mishandle, kill these kinds of individuals based on their skin color. This is in late Kemet. Now let's go back earlier in Kemet, and we're going to deal with skin color as well. In the hymn to the Aten by the Per'a or the Ensut, the king, the sovereign, Akhenaten. The great hymn to the Aten, we have a link there. It's talking about the Aten, the sun, and he's extolling the sun, the Aten, and all the great things that the sun does, and talking about you create the country after your will. When you were alone, people, all herds, cattle, all that is on earth, what goes on, the legs, meaning the animals going on the legs, what is in the sky and flies with its wings. You created all these things. He then says the countries of Chad and Cush, the land of Kemet, you give each man his place. The country Chad is Syria. Cush, of course, is Kanat, Nubia, and so forth, and the land of Kemet says you give each man his place. You care for their needs. Each individual receives his food, and their lifetime is counted. Their tongues differ in language, just as their characters, according to their characters and their skin, their characters is according to their skin. You made the inhabitants of the desert so different. Some people try to mistranslate that. Instead of saying, you know, their tongues are different, you know, in language and speech, their character according to their skin. The term for skins is anim, which means skin, and that's important because enam in Twi in the Akan language means skin. It's the same term. When it's talking about your character, it's according to your skin. It's talking about the skin color and the character associated with the skin color. They use the term kedu, meaning your character, disposition, and forms and so forth. So sometimes they try to mistranslate and try to say, well, you know, they're talking about the form and it's not talking about the character, and they're not relating the character to the skin and so forth, and they're not talking about the skin color has something to do with the form. It's actually talking about form, character, disposition is all connected. It's all the same piece. In order to prove that, we can look in the Akan tradition and show the association with form and with character and with disposition. So the term for essential nature in Akan is su, or esu, your essential nature, that which distinguishes you from every other people. Derivation of that term is sun, sun, which is your spirit body. Rooted in sun sun, the spirit body is your su, or esu, which is your essential nature, which makes you different and unique from every other individual. And of course, that's because you have a specific function to execute in the world that's encoded within your own crowd and so forth. So your su is your character, your essential nature. The term abine means form or shape, but it also means fence or a structure. So abine is a fence that's like around an enclosure, and it's protecting the enclosure, what's inside. So when you see a fence or enclosure, it's around something that's inside. And so that's abine in Akan. The term su means essential nature, but then we also have the term subine, which means character. That's su and bine together. You can have subine pa, which means good character. You can have subine bon, which is evil character. Bon means evil in Akan, also bani, meaning evil, in ancient Kemet. Bon means evil. Bani also means evil. These are the same terms in both languages. Su means essential nature. Subine, which is the abine or the enclosure, that structure around the su, is your character or your behavior. Subine pa, good character, behavior, that structure, that which is around, that shape, that form, that encloses what's inside. What's inside is the nature. If you have a building that has a structure on the outside of it, it's protecting or enclosing something that's on the inside. The abine around the su is the behavior or the expression around the essential nature. So you have your essential nature, and that is manifest through a certain form, an expression, which is your culture. Your character is manifest, is a manifestation of what is inside of you, your essential nature, which is your su. So the su is the essential nature. Subine is the expression of your nature, which is your character. That's why su and subine, essential nature and character and form, it's the same here when they're talking about your character, the kedu, your disposition, your character, your form. Those are all tied together just like su and subine is in relationship to your enam or enamu in Kemet, meaning your skin, enam in Akan, meaning your skin. So it's saying tongues, different language, just like your dispositions and your character is according to your skin. They're talking about the Apin made people different, put them in different places, and their characters are according to their skin. We just read, this is from the Kims of the Apin during the 18th dynasty. You go to Lake Kemet, they're still talking about skin color having to do with the disposition of an individual to the extent that when somebody had a reddish skin color and they were associated with the negative aspects that were associated with Set, and they would kill them if they saw that skin color and that hair color. They'd just kill them or abuse them or kill them because, if you have that skin color, you're associated with that kind of energy, we're just going to kill you because we know you're going to create that kind of disorder. So skin color, race, having to do specifically with your character or disposition. That was not created by Europeans in the 12,800s or 1800s. It wasn't a social construct created by the whites and their offspring, as Negroes would like us to believe, because they're aping the whites and offspring. These are specific texts from ancient Kemet that deal with this information in detail. Now we're going to go to our text when we talked about Kemet-Urt, Hasar-Aset, and the enslavement and restoration of Afurakani, Afurakaitni people in Amenti in the West. Before we get into that, I just want to say there are only 5 minutes left in the live stream. For those who are on the Internet and they're listening through the Internet on Blog Talk, if you want to listen past 11 o'clock, then you must call in, because at 11 o'clock the Internet version will cut off, but you'll still be able to listen on the phone. We'll probably go a few minutes in overtime. If you would like to continue to listen, the number is 657-383-0635. You have 3 minutes and 34 seconds to call in before it cuts off. All right. And for those who aren't going to be able to stay on, we just wanted to say one of the announcements. September 6th, we will be in Philadelphia for our presentation. We were there on August 9th. They honored us invited us as an honor to be keynote speaker at the Sankofa Afashe, or the Sankofa Festival of Philadelphia. So we did that on August 9th. That was a presentation for that outdoor event. For just the general population of our people, it was just a short 30-minute presentation, approximately talking about culture in general, Sankofa, Nabusia family, and clan structure and so forth, and our identity. When we go back to Philly on September 6th, this will be a regular presentation. 3-4 hours, we'll be doing presentation, having questions and answers and so forth. We typically pass out a free copy of one of our soft cover books to everybody who attends our events. Our events, that we never charge for events. So we'll be putting out a notification about that coming up very soon. So continue to check the website, check the archives here, but check our website, ojidafo.com, as well as our afuraka-afurakayet.ning.com social network. And we're also on Facebook, Akafo Nanatsum group on Facebook. So that'll be coming up. We'll have the details this week. For those also who didn't hear the show last night, we do have our 10 soft cover books available. You can they range between $8 and $11. We also have, and we're talking about many of these various subjects and in much more detail, you can go to the website, ojidafo.com, on the Nhoma page, the publications page, and you'll see a link to that on the front page of the site, ojidafo.com. So you can go and check those out. And we also have the piece where if people want to purchase and sell the publications in your area to coworkers or friends or whatever, you can purchase them wholesale and sell them retail to generate income for yourself, as well as, we're also getting the information out at the same time. So you can contact us for that as well, 202-717-0057. You can also hit us up on email for that, and we can, get you that information. But please check out our books. All of the ebook versions of our books are free downloads. The soft cover versions, we print ourselves on our own printers in color. So when you purchase those, that supports us in our efforts to give free presentations, training, substance abuse abstinence programs and things like that. All of that is on the website, so you'll see all that information. So please go to the website and support what we're doing by purchasing those publications. You can also make a donation. If you make a donation of $15 or more, we will send you a copy of one of our books anyway. So please support, and we appreciate your support. Okay, and now we're going to get to this other document. Kemet-Urt, Hasar-Aset, and the enslavement and restoration of the Afurakani, Afurakaitni, and African in Amenti, the West. We just wanted to pull out that document because we wanted to show as well in our Khan culture, just like you have Kamau, the black people in ancient Kemet. The land is called Kemet, meaning the black country. The desert lands outside of a matter called Deshert, meaning Desher meaning red, Deshert meaning the red land, the red country, Kamet meaning the black country. It does reference the land. It also references the people. It also references the divinities, Kam-Ur, which is a title of Asar, the great black one, and Desher, which is a title of Set, meaning the red one. And the followers of Set are the Desheru, meaning the red one. Kamau or Kamet, the people of Kamet, meaning the black ones, the children of Asar and so forth, the black silk that's deposited on the banks of the river after the yearly flood. This is where the termination or the designation Kamet or the black country comes from. But it also deals with the people. We're talking about dark brown people with black undertones who are the people of Kamau people, then dark brown people with red undertones who are the Desheru. Just like you have the Kamau and the Desheru, the blacks and the reds in Kamet. When you look at the people of Kana or Nubia in ancient times, you'll see them standing side by side. One is red, one is black, one is red, one is black, and so forth. Dark brown people with red undertones, dark brown people with black undertones. The people are connected to the energy of the divinities of black, like Asar. They're the ones with dark brown people with black undertones. Ones who carry the energy of the red, quote-unquote, divinities like Set or other divinities like Setchima and other divinities whose sacred color is red or red in another combination, they will be dark brown people with red undertones because they carry that fiery energy and manifest through their spirit and manifest through their bodies and in their phenotypes. So we show a couple of pictures, a Maasai woman, Desheru, dark brown with red undertones. We show a Seder woman, a Kamau, dark brown person with black undertone. In the Akan tradition, we have the blacks and the reds as well, and it's dealing specifically with skin color, and they're literally labeled the blacks and the reds. For example, in the Ayoko Apusia amongst the Bono, as well as amongst the Asante, you have the red Oyoko, Oyoko Kaka, and you have the black Oyoko, Oyoko Tuntun. They're talking about skin color, but it's also associated with certain ancestrally inherited abosom or deities that color the energy of the person that also manifests through the phenotype of the people and their characteristics. The people, redder people, you know, that red, fiery energy, people more fired up, they have a certain disposition. Black energy, a little bit more cool and have a different disposition in the way they operate in the world. That is directly related to skin color, disposition, spirituality. We're talking about race. We're talking about a biological basis for race. We're talking about the deities that cause the different manifestations of dark brown with black undertones, dark brown with red undertones, and we can read the color of the skins of the people and know what kind of energy governs them and can even predict behavior. And we even have names associated with that, not just clans, but even names of people specifically. For example, the term for black people in general in the Akan language is Obibrifo, or Ebibifo. Bri means black or dark. When it's dark outside, Bri, black, dark. Obibrini means one Obibi person or black person, Obibini. Obibifo means the group fo of black people, Ebibifo. And then Ebibi mine or Ebibri mine is the black nation, meaning that's the term in Twi for Africa, Afuraka, Afraikai. So we literally call ourselves black people, Obibini, black person, Obibifo, black people, Ebibi mine, the black nation. So when people say, well, there's no such thing as a black land or black people or black nation anywhere in the world, they're repeating idiocy from the whites and their offspring that's deliberate, but then some of our people, again, who simply mimic their white masters and weave that nonsense into pseudo-Afrocentric jargon. And they begin to say, well, we didn't call ourselves black. We didn't refer. Well, in our contradiction, we call ourselves black. The same thing, same term for black is what we call ourselves, every black person. Now, you also have somebody who's extra darker than somebody else. And people can be very dark black or just regular black. They would be called obri or black. Well, the other word for black is tuntun, which means black. Somebody could be called Kwesi Tuntun because he's darker than his brother. They have the same father, same mother, but he's darker than his brother, Kojo. And he's Kwesi Tuntun, or Tuntuntun meaning black, meaning very dark in comparison to the other black people. All the people are called Bri or Obidri for black people, but then you have somebody who's Bri, meaning black, meaning he's darker than the average person, even though everybody is called black. So yes, he's called extra black, so to speak. Also, Obri Fo also means somebody of unusual power. Tum or somebody, Otumfo, meaning a powerful person. Tum meaning black or dark. Otumfo meaning not only a black or dark person, but somebody with extra power. Bri meaning black. Obri Fo or Bri meaning somebody who's more black than the other people, but also somebody with extensive or unusual power. The color is associated with their character or disposition. We're talking about race. So every time from this point forward, when you hear Negroes talk who believe that they're intellectuals or believe that they're spiritualists or believe that they're traditional and they speak in a traditional language and try to promote this nonsense that race didn't exist, there's no biological basis for race, we didn't separate people to talk about skin color in association with characteristics, that's all foolishness, it's all a lie. So if they teach you that, and they're repeating the nonsense of the whites and their offspring and the pseudoscience of the whites and their offspring, and then they're confronted with this actual information from the text that they claim that they have read, text from ancient Kemet, that they've mistranslated, and they can't translate it. They listen to the translations of the whites and their offspring, when clearly the texts say and identify skin color and the association of characteristics and disposition with skin color. They claim to have read these texts, but clearly they have not, or they've read false interpretation. They're showing you they don't know what they're talking about. But then they also can't go into the cosmology of the culture, whether it's in ancient Kemet or around the continent, and show within our own culture, in our own practices, the difference between people of different skin colors and their disposition spiritually based on the deities that govern their blood circle, which causes their skin color to be a certain, manifest in a certain shade. We know what deities govern them. We know the sacred colors of the deity and the energy that manifests through the body of the person through their phenotype, and we can show that connection between the color and the abosa. So much so that we refer to people as the blacks and the reds in our Khan culture, just like we did in ancient Kanat and Kemet, the blacks and the reds. So in this article, we go into that on pages 2 and 3 in that particular section. So I just wanted to make sure that I covered that. So if you look at that article, Kam or Kamet Ori Asar said in the enslavement and restoration of the Asura Akane Afrai Kaini in the West, in Amenti in the West, we talk about that. And just to read that particular section, we must recognize that the terms Kamal and Desheru, meaning the black people, Egyptians, and the red people, those outside of Kemet, including some Kanitu Nubians, references not only the black country and red country, they reference the black soil and the red land, desert and red clay. They also refer to the skin color of the people based on the spiritual energy that governs them. This fact has been lost to those commentators who are not intimately familiar with and engaged in the practices of Afura Kani Afurai Kaidi, or African ancestral religion. So this is, again, why in our Kana culture, Oyoko Koko, the red Oyoko, Oyoko Tuntun, the black Oyoko, talking about skin color, and people can look at the people and say, they're one of the Koko, the red, this other one, they're one of the blacks. It has nothing to do with mixing with Europeans. We're not talking about mulattoes. We're talking about the difference between somebody who may look like Wesley Snipes or something, being a caw-caw, a dark brown person with red undertones, and then you see somebody who's much darker than him, one of the Tum Tum, because they have black undertones, and we would look at the reds and the blacks and can distinguish between the two. That derives from the land itself, just like in Kemet, Kamau, the black country, Desher, the red land, the red country, the desert, and the red clay. In Akan culture, again, Asase means earth, like Asase Afur, the earth mother, Asase Yah, the other earth mother divinity. Asase itself means earth. We have Asase Koko, the red Asase, meaning red desert, red clay, earth, and Asase Tum Tum, the black earth. We have stories in Akan culture when you talk the people, in the Bono tradition, some of the people who are talking about, they have songs when they talk about, we come from Amuowi, and we travel long distances, Asase Koko Ma, children of the red earth. They're identifying themselves with Asase Koko, the red earth, and the Oyoko Koko, the red people, the red Oyoko, and so forth. So that is across the board. It's clearly demonstrated, and not just in our Akan culture, but cultures across the continent. And even when we get to America, we talk about the difference between our children. We can see one is, you know, reddish, somebody call somebody red and so forth, and the other one black or whatever. Sometimes because of ignorance, we use derogatory terms, but we still carry that same notion because it's been with us for thousands of years. But when people are involved with these actual divinities and know who they are, then they can clearly see this information in the text. It's right there in the text because it's still in the practice of the people. So, yes, the Kemet is the black land, the black country. Deshert is the red land, the black red country. It's based on the country itself, the topography of the country. It's also dealing with the people and their skin color. It's also dealing with the deity. That's why black Asar is shown with black skin when he's called Kam-Ur, Set, shown with red skin. When Asar is shown resurrected and dealing with the fertility of the earth, he is shown with green skin, and then he's called Watch-Ur, meaning the great green one. Again, the skin having to do, talking about skin color, but also talking about disposition, fertility, and so forth. Skin color associated with character and disposition. That's the notion of race that comes directly from our people. It has nothing to do with the whites and offspring. It has to do with us. And then when we come in contact with them, they lose their pigmentation. We had designations for them. And then spirits of disorder and knowing who they are. So, and we talked about reincarnation and the identity of a spirit transcarnationally through successive incarnations. And then we get back to the fact that identity-wise, Afurakani, Afuraikaiti people have a kra, a soul of divine consciousness. White Asians, white Europeans, white Hindus, white Hispanics, white Latinos, white Europeans, white Americans, none of these individuals have a kra. So even if they have a little brown skin, a little melanin, a little fuller lip than the other person, or a little fuller nose, or a little bit of curlier hair than the other individual, they are still spirits of disorder. They are Achiwadiefo, spirits of disorder. They are not Afurakani. They are not Afuraikaili. Individuals like Jennifer Lopez and individuals like that, they are not part of our culture. They are not part of our people. They are spirits of disorder. They are black people who are enslaved in the region called Puerto Rico, and then there are white people who are in Puerto Rico. Those white Eurasians, they're Asians. The black people who are Afurakani, Afuraikaiti, they are black people just like everybody else. There are black people who are Afurakani, Afuraikaiti people in Cuba. There are black people, Afurakani, Afuraikaiti people all over South America, Central America, the Caribbean, North America, who are forced to speak Spanish, forced to speak French, forced to speak Portuguese, forced to speak Dutch, all these different things, and they have those names and got caught up in Catholicism and a number of different practices. Clear distinction between those who are actually Afurakani, Afuraikaiti people and those who are not. And we, of course, our webcast, who is Afurakani, Afuraikaiti, and who is not, we go into detail about that. But we can tell the difference. So it's not just anybody with a little bit, little light skin, they're part of our family, they are not. when we get to the question, finally, also just to address about mulattoes, because some people are dealing with this foolish notion of, again, aping the whites and their offspring. You are what your mother is. Or some people say, you are what your father is. Very often people involved in the false religions of Islam or Christianity, they'll say, you are who your father is, because that comes from the nonsense of the infection of Islam and Christianity, even when Islam and Christianity and Judaism has infected traditional culture on the continent. Just like we were forced to speak English over here and Spanish and so forth, people were colonized on the continent. And they speak French, and they speak English, and some of them speak Portuguese and this other nonsense because they were colonized. Even before the Europeans colonized them, some of them got caught up with the white Arabs. And our culture was infected by that interaction with the white Arabs. So some of that filthy, degenerate, pseudo-religious culture, pseudo-religious practice gets incorporated by misguided Negroes into the traditional religion. And they say, oh, this is part of our ancient religion. And it's not. It's just Islam, that perversion, infecting the traditional religion. So they'll say, oh, you are who your father is. Some people say, you are who your mother is. In specific instances, in a traditional culture, like in the Akan culture, that's a matrifocal society to a certain extent, then the Abusia is matricircular or matrilineal. But that's based on the agreement we have with the Nananoman Samafo and the Abosom, and Nyamewa send us through a specific Abusia, because that's the structure that we have established over thousands of years. However, that same structure was disrupted through the Musuo Kesi, or the Great Perversity, the enslavement era. So it's no longer the exact same fast rule. You're still connected to that same Abusia, that matricircular clan, but you have to find out what clan you are from based on what clan you came from your Nananoman Samafo. Because, for example, we talked about that individual who was Akan, maybe he was from the Asona clan, the matrilineal clan Asona, who lived in Kumasi 300 years ago. And his descendants, enslaved in America, walking around in America 300 years later, he's an ancestor. Say one of his descendants, a male descendant, foolishly hooks up with a white female and copulates with that white female. But this ancestor has been guiding this young male and connected to this young male as he grew up. And it's time for this person to be drawn into a womb. If this ancestor had been a Nana, living in harmony with divine order, was a spiritually cultivated elder, when he made his transition, his spirit wouldn't even be able to be drawn into that white womb. But if he was somebody who was not necessarily spiritually cultivated, he may have been a nice person, or he may have been a fool. But even if he was just a nice person, but he wasn't necessarily spiritually cultivated, then his spirit can be drawn. He's still connected to his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson. It's time for him to be drawn into the world. He tried to guide his grandson away from the white female, but he got with the white female anyway. And that magnetism, he's drawn to that individual's sperm cell. It's a magnet for his ancestors. He's connected to him, and he's drawn into the womb in that fashion. Because that sperm cell connected with the ovum of that white female, his spirit is invested in a body that's going to come out light brown. He's going to be looking like, you know, Tiger Woods or something. A white mother, black father. Who is that individual? He's the same Akan individual. He's an Akan ancestor, so he is an Afurakani male. Even though his so-called mother is white, that's really not his mother in the real sense. He was with the young man even when the young man was born and growing up, before he ever met that white female. Their family, that white female, is a foreigner. She's a stranger. She's a criminal. The young black male made a mistake and connected with that female and forced one of his ancestors to be born through that situation, because one of his ancestors wasn't spiritually elevated enough to be able to repel that womb space. So he's drawn into the womb, but he's still that Akan ancestor from 300 years ago who comes through. So that particular mulatto is an Afurakani individual with a crop. So that mulatto is one of our people. But what if it wasn't him who came through? What if that black male copulates with this white female and one of her filthy, degenerate white ancestors is drawn into the womb and is born? He's going to be born with the same light brown skin looking like Tiger Woods, but guess what? He's not Afurakani. He's that white, Swedish male ancestor of the white female. He's returned through a melanin-dominant body, but he's still a spirit of disorder. An Echiwadiefo, one of the Echiwadiefo, a spirit of disorder, divinely hated by the Supreme Being. That body of melanin that he has now will not make him all of a sudden have a crop. He's just a wolf in sheep's clothing, so to speak. He's a cancerous cell operating or masquerading as a person of color now. Very often, right off, we can tell who these people are because they typically identify with the white side of the family. They don't want to have anything to do with black people. They want to identify as white because that is who they are. This is probably the first time he incarnated through a light brown body. In all his previous lifetimes, he was a cracker in Sweden or somewhere else. This time, because of what his descendant did, he was brought through a mulatto-type body. He is not one of us. But if it was the other situation, where an Akan person is drawn through this womb, he's the same individual, comes through a light brown body, he has a weaker body now, light brown, mulatto-type body, but he's still that same Akan spirit connected to those same Nananoma and Samanfo. If he's just basically normal, he will repel that white female. He'll disown her as his mother. He will no longer deal with her. Even when she dies, he won't go to the funeral. He'll have nothing to do with her, and he'll deal with his black side, and he'll get back to normal. And he'll marry an Afurakani woman. He'll have children. They'll bring back their ancestresses and ancestors, and they will breed out that light skin color. Within a couple of generations, you won't even know that a cracker had polluted the blood circle. So we're showing real identity based on real culture, not from, number one, the whites and their offspring, number two, these Negroes who work on behalf of the whites and their offspring promoting misinformation in pseudo-comedic ideologies, promoting misinformation through pseudo-Yoruba traditions, pseudo-Akan traditions, pseudo-Vodun traditions, pseudo-traditional religion traditions. What they're doing is weaving in white pseudo-cosmology, pseudo-esotericism, the Kabbalah and Sufism and Jainism and Vedanta and all of this nonsense, even the misinformation regarding reincarnation as postulated by the Hindus who don't know what they're talking about or by the Asians who don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand how reincarnation works with our people, so they can't speak on that. So you don't go to Hindu texts looking for proper information about reincarnation. You don't go to the Tibetan Bhāra-thāsa-grāl or the Tibetan Book of the Dead looking for proper information about reincarnation. You don't scan through the books of Asia looking for our culture. Our culture is within the clans, within the blood, within the Musiakuo, the clans of our people, within the ancestresses and ancestors. It's encoded within your own Akra. Okay, so looks like we don't have any questions on the phone lines. We're going to end it right here. Just one question I see. Somebody asked about extraterrestrials. When people are talking about extraterrestrials and coming to Earth and seeding the Earth and we're descended from extraterrestrials, that's all 100% inaccurate. The whites and our offspring promote that nonsense because they would like for us to believe that anybody other than us built the pyramids and established civilization. Since they couldn't prove that, since all the archaeology and genetics and anthropology all proves that we established civilization, then they'll say, okay, well, it was another civilization that came from the stars, seeded civilization, and then left, and black people found the civilization there and just occupied all the temples and everything and just imitated what they saw, the whites who came from the Pleiades star system or some other nonsense like that. Then brainwash black people, take that information because they feel inferior and inadequate. They worship the whites and their offspring because they're mentally enslaved. They want to feel good And that kind of information, even though it's ignorant, makes that kind of person feel good about themselves. So they decide to blacken it up and start saying, well, the extraterrestrials was actually black, and the Nephilim were black, and all this other foolishness. And they take that white doctrine that was manufactured by whites, blacken it up, and then make it real. It's no different than taking Santa Claus and the elves, making them black, and of course some Negroes do that, and then saying, well, Santa Claus was real, the elves are real, that's part of my family, I can trace my family tree back to the elves and Kris Kringle. It's no different. There are no extraterrestrials flying around, abducting people, building civilizations, none of that. That's never been accurate. And of course, they're not just people here. Remember, our people have been colonized on the continent for decades, just like we were enslaved for centuries here. So once they're colonized, that information begins to creep into the culture. Over the past, especially over the past couple of hundred years with the colonization, Christianity, but also with Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism. So you'll start seeing Hindu images showing up in Bodoon temples and Buddhist images showing up in Bodoon temples. They are not associated with ancient ancestral sibs or clans from ancient black India. Nonsense. What it is white people, white Hindus, coming into Togo and Benin and so forth, selling their little chromolithographs of these white Hindu deities, fake deities, Negroes taking this nonsense, hanging them up in shrines, pouring libation, communicating with these deceased white, discarnate criminal spirits, passing them off as deities, and then saying, oh, well, this is part of our ancient culture, which it is not. They're not dealing with some ancient Afurakani, Afurai Kaitni culture in India and black India from ancient Dravidian culture and so forth. That's not what they're dealing with. You see those Hindu images, Buddhist images, those are the spirits of dead white individuals that they're trying to blacken up. And the spirits that they're dealing with, when you see those images in those shrines, you know that no real Vodou are in those shrines. They will not dwell in shrines where you have images of white mermaids and white, you know, Buddhas and white blonde-haired individuals and Shiva and Ganesh and all this other nonsense. The Vodou will depart. And the only spirits that will take up residence in those vessels are discarnate, wayward, criminal-type spirits, some of them the whites and their offspring, and some of them the criminals of the society. And then people are doing divination, making blood sacrifices and so forth to these discarnate, wayward, criminal-type spirits, disordered spirits, and calling themselves practicing Vodou and doing divination and getting information and passing it on and initiating people and everything else to fake spirits. So that's what's going on. All right, so again, we'd like to say, Yedase, we thank you for tuning in. Tomorrow, Igua Marketplace Day, we will send out a notification to see who the guest on the show will be. So we'll send that out later tonight or by early tomorrow morning. We will send that out. Again, we appreciate you tuning in to the shows. Of course, all of the shows are archived, so you can go back. We've started doing the shows on March 27th on Blog Talk. Of course, on YouTube, we have 48 videos. Many of them were shows we were doing on Ustream a year ago. And, of course, then we have our 15 books and our 60-plus articles. All of the PDF versions, ebook versions, of course, are free. And, again, for those who, if you support our work and you want to assist us in continuing this kind of work, we have more publications coming out that we are working on. The way you can support, which can support yourself as well, purchase the soft cover versions of the publications. You can also, again, you can, if you want to distribute them, sell them to or show them to friends and family, and of course, when they see those color publications and the information contained within, very often they'll spend $8 or $9 and buy a book from you, and you'll be able to generate income for yourself and also get this word out. You'll also be assisting us in covering the expenses. For example, Blog Talk Radio, we pay a monthly expense. Websites, we give away free books at every presentation. When we do presentations in different cities, we do not charge admissions fees for people to attend. We never do that, and we don't charge organizes a speaker's fee or a per diem. Some people charge $1,000 to come out and speak, or $1,500 or whatever, or $500. We don't charge a speaker's fee at all. We come out and do that work, and we give that information to the community for free. So in order to do that, that takes, you know, finance. So when we sell these soft cover publications, we can use the revenue to continue to invest in the community, give those free workshops out. We have ritual methods to overcome substance abuse, to achieve substance abuse abstinence, overcome domestic abuse, intergenerational trauma, transcarnational trauma. That's all on the website. So again, we say Yerase, we appreciate your support. Please support our soft cover publications on our ojirafo.com and on my page. And we will be back on tomorrow at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, same channel. Check us out on Facebook, afuraka.afuraikaet. We will meet you again. Yebeshia.